The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. We are so pleased you could join us today. Before we begin, please take a moment to silence your cell phones. I'd like to remind you that no flash photography is permitted during today's event. And following the event, a book signing will take place upstairs in the lobby. It is now my distinct pleasure to introduce you to the award-winning, soul-shaking author, Jesmyn Ward. Her work... Her work has been compared to that of William Faulkner, Zora Neale Hurston, Maya Angelou, and Toni Morrison. Born and raised in Mississippi, she has used her written work to pay homage to her roots and her family. Her first two novels, Where the Line Bleeds and National Book Award winner Salvage the Bones, examine the wrenching experiences of life after Katrina. And in her memoir, Men We Reaped, she writes of the deaths of five important young men in her life. Having grown up in poverty in Mississippi, she now brings her readers into its homes, families, communities, and landscapes with grit and clarity. She shares these gifts as an associate professor of creative writing at Tulane University. Last year, she became the first woman to win a second National Book Award for her stunning novel, Sing, Unburied, Sing, a 21st century road novel slash ghost story about the difficulty of family bonds and the ugly underside of the American story. The National Book Award judges explained in their award citation, Sing, Unburied, Sing is a narrative so beautifully taut and heartbreakingly eloquent that it stops the breath. Entertainment Weekly hails, Ward has emerged as one of the most searing and singularly gifted writers working today. Absorbing the harsh beauty of her writing isn't easy. Reading Sing sometimes feels like staring into the sun, but she also makes it impossible to turn away. Her talk today will be in conversation with my dear colleague, Kalayla Williams, Director of Neighborhood Enrichment Programming here at the library and creative writer in her own right. So ladies and gentlemen, please now welcome Jesmyn Ward.
So this is truly exciting. This is truly going to be, this is truly a treat. And we're going to start off, Jesmyn, if you wouldn't mind reading, and maybe speaking a little bit about the layers of the book, just if you want to read and talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have three different very short sections to read from. I thought it would be easiest to begin at the beginning, so I'll read a little bit from the first page of the first chapter. So, you know, Sing, Unburied, Sing, for those of you who have not read the book, it's a cross between a road trip and a ghost story. And there are three main narrators in the book. Jojo, he's a 13-year-old mixed-race boy, you know, living in Mississippi, basically with his grandparents. And so he tells part of the story. And his mother, Leonie, she's in her 20s. She struggles with addiction. She's not the best mom. She can be abusive. She can also be neglectful. Sometimes she's neglectful of her children. She tells, she also, you know, tells part of the story. And then there is a ghost. Right, or there are a couple different ghosts, but there's one particular ghost, the ghost of a 13-year-old boy who was sent to Parchman Prison in Mississippi in the 1940s, and so he tells part of the story. And the novel opens when Leonie, Jojo's mother, finds out that Jojo's father, who is white, Michael, is being released from Parchman Prison, right? And this is all set in present day. And so she decides to pack up, you know, Jojo and his younger sister, Kayla, and get one of her friends to ride along and to go on this road trip to central Mississippi, central northern Mississippi, to pick up Michael from jail. And so it begins in a very simple way, but then it becomes a bit complicated as they travel farther north. In some ways, it's interesting because in some ways, as they travel north and in really into like the heart of Mississippi and the heart of the Delta, and you know, they begin to have these experiences, you know, where they're sort of, they're in, you know, difficult situations, right, that are more complicated because of who they are, right, because they're like poor people, poor black people. It almost seems like they're traveling back in time at the same time, right? Because, you know, Jojo was thinking about this story that Pop told him, because Pop was also in jail in Parchman in the 1940s with Richie, the boy ghost, right? So Jojo was like thinking about this story that Pop told him, right? And as he's thinking about it, you know, it keeps popping up, and it almost feels like you're moving back and you're, you know, like traveling backwards in time as they are nearing, getting closer and closer to Parchman Prison. So I hope that's helpful. Okay, chapter one, Jojo. I like to think I know what death is. I like to think that is something I could look at straight. When Pop tell me he need my help and I see that black knife slid into the belt of his pants, I follow Pop out the house, try to keep my back straight, my shoulders even as a hanger. That's how Pop walks. I try to look like this is normal and born so Pop will think I've earned these 13 years, so Pop will know I'm ready to pull what needs to be pulled, separate innards from muscle, organs from cavities. I want Pop to know I can get bloody. Today's my birthday. I grab the door so it don't slam, ease it into the jam. I don't want Mama Kayla to wake up with none of us in the house. Better for him to sleep. Better for my little sister Kayla to sleep, because on nights when Leonie's out working, she wake up every hour, sit straight up in the bed and scream. Better for Grandma Mam to sleep, because the chemo done dried her up and hollowed her out, the way the sun and the air do water oaks. Pop weaves in and out of the trees, straight and slim and brown as a young pine tree. He spits in the dry red dirt, and the wind makes the trees wave. It's cold. This spring is stubborn. Most days it won't make way for warmth. The chill stays like water in a bad draining tub. I left my hoodie on the floor in Leonie's room, where I sleep, and my t-shirt is thin, but I don't rub my arms. If I let the cold goad me, I know when I see the goat, I'll flinch or frown when Pop cuts the throat. And Pop, being Pop, will see. So that's the very beginning. And so here's a short passage from Leonie, Jojo's mother, and she's talking about, so when Leonie has a brother, Given, and when Leonie and Given were teenagers, Given was actually murdered, right? And Given's murderers or murderer was never held accountable for his death. And so years later, right, Leonie is in her 20s. She struggles with addiction, and she finds herself, like whenever she uses, she sees a phantom of Given. And so this is about her sort of talking about what the first time was like when she got high and she saw a ghost of her brother. 3 years ago, I did a line and saw Given for the first time. It wasn't my first line, but Michael had just gone to jail. I started doing it often. Every other day, I was bending over a table, sifting powder into lines, inhaling. I knew I shouldn't have. I was pregnant. but I couldn't help wanting to feel the coke go up my nose, shoot straight to my brain, and burn up all the sorrow and despair I felt at Michael being gone. The first time Given showed up, I was at a party in the Kill, and my brother walked through there with no bullet holes in his chest or in his neck, whole and long-limbed, like always, but not smirking. He was shirtless and red about the neck and face like he'd been running, but his chest was still as stone, still as he must have been after Michael's cousin shot him. I thought about Mama's little forest, the 10 trees she'd planted in an ever-widening spiral on every death day. I ground my gums sore staring at Given. I ate him with my eyes. He tried to talk to me, but I couldn't hear him, and he just got more and more frustrated. He sat on the table in front of me, right on the mirror with the coke on it. I couldn't put my face in it again without putting it in his lap, so we sat there staring at each other, me trying not to react so I wouldn't look crazy to my friends, who were singing along to country music, kissing sloppily in corners like teenagers, walking in zigzags with their arms linked out into the dark. Given looked at me like he did when we were little, and I broke the new fishing pole Pop got him, murderous. When I came down, I almost ran out to my car. I was shaking so hard, I could hardly put my key in the ignition. Given climbed in next to me, sat in the passenger seat, and turned and looked at me with a face of stone. I quit, I said. I swear I won't do it no more. He rode with me to the house, and I left him sitting in the passenger seat as the sun softened and lit the edges of the sky rising. I crept into Mama's bedroom and watched her sleep, dusted her shrine, her rosary draped over her Virgin Mary statue in the corner, nestled among blue-gray candles, river rocks, three dried cattails, a single yam. When I saw Given not Given for the first time, I didn't tell my mama nothing. And then here's a small section from Richie's perspective. And Richie is the ghost of the 13-year-old boy who served time with Pop, JoJo's grandfather and Leonie's father, during the 1940s. And he's talking about what the beginning of his afterlife was like, right? And he comes to and he realizes that he's dead, and then he's in one place, and then this guide comes for him, right? And he's able to fly out of the place that he's trapped in, and he thinks he's, you know, it's his version of heading towards the light, right? But then Parchman pulls him to it, and he sinks, and he's trapped in Parchman. So this is Richie sort of talking about being trapped in Parchman as a ghost. I didn't understand time either when I was young. How could I know that after I died, Parchman would pull me from the sky? How could I imagine Parchman would pull me to it and refuse to let go? And how could I conceive that Parchman was past, present, and future all at once? That the history and sentiment that carved the place out of the wilderness would show me that time is a vast ocean and that everything is happening at once. I was trapped as I'd been in the room of pines where I woke up, trapped as I was before the white snake, the black vulture, came for me. Parchman had imprisoned me again. I wandered the new prison night after night. It was a place bound by cinder blocks and cement. I watched the men fucking fight in the dark, so twisted up in each other, I couldn't tell where one man ended and another began. I spent so many turns of the earth at the new Parchman. I watched for the dark bird, but he was absent. I despaired, burrowed into the dirt, slept, and rose to witness the newborn Parchman. I watched chained men clear the land and lay the first logs for the first barracks for gunmen and trusty shooters. I thought I was in a bad dream. I thought that if I burrowed and slept and woke again, I would be back in the new Parchman. But instead, when I slept and woke, I was in the Delta before the prison. And native men were ranging over that rich earth, hunting and taking breaks to play stickball and smoke. Bewildered, I burrowed and slept and woke to the new Parchman again, to men who wore their hair long and braided to their scalps, who sat for hours in small, windowless rooms, staring at big black boxes that streamed dreams. Their faces in the blue light were stiff as corpses. I burrowed and slept and woke many times before I realized this was the nature of time.
Thank you so much. That was a beautiful read. Your language is so lush, and it's so it's almost delicious, but it's so hard. I think as a Black person and as a Southerner especially, I read all of your work on edge, and in this, when I read this book, I had goosebumps the whole time. I read it with goosebumps. I want to talk about the role of men in all of your works, because men are at the forefront of all of the works that you write, Black male characters especially. Could you speak to this?
I don't know exactly why that is the case. I mean, I do think that Black men figure very prominently in all my work, especially like in a book, say, a book like Men We Reaped, right, which was my memoir. I think that it probably has something to do with the fact that my brother died when he was 19, right, and he was hit by a drunk driver. And that loss has informed, I think, a lot of my has informed my like my motivation to write, and I think that it's also informed a lot of my my ideas about what I write about. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's made me think about losing my brother has made me think about the person that he might have become, and who he might have been if he had been alive, and the kind of and how he might have figured out what it means to be a man in America, what it means to be a Black man in America, what it means to be a Black man in the South, right? So I think that loss and that sense of grief makes me think about him often, and then that finds its way into my work. I also think that there's something of him in most of my male characters. And I think that's the case because he was my model. You know what I'm saying? Like, my dad left when we were young, and I love my dad, but he was like in and out of our lives. Mm-hmm. But my brother was always there. Like, he was the constant. So when I was trying to figure out, when I'm like thinking about like masculinity and mm-hmm. what that means and the South and just mm-hmm. all these things, like, I'm looking to my brother, right, to try to figure out how all this will work. So he's my reference, and so I think that in that way he finds his way again into my work and into my characters again and again.
Mm-hmm. And there's a sense, I think, of we're going to pull back to sing Unburied Sing, but there's a sense of masculinity. There's a culture of masculinity, but there's also a culture of Black masculinity. Mm-hmm. There's a culture of it's to me, it's not being afraid of the forces that don't care if you live or die, mm-hmm. and it's almost staring death in the eye. Can you talk? Do you feel that way?
Yes, I think that is part of. I think that's an understanding that many of my characters have come to in my work. Like, I think that they often are very clear-eyed about how America views them, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and how America and especially the South. Like, how she silences them, how she limits them, how she reduces them, right? But they persist in the face of that, you know, and they live in spite of that. And I think one of the things too that that I like about that I appreciate, right, in all my writing, whether or not I'm writing about men or women, is I appreciate being able to write about characters and make them complicated, mm-hmm. you know, and make them, I appreciate being able to sort of write about a character like Jojo, you know, who's a 13-year-old boy. So I think that there, you know, there are certain things that a reader might expect from him at the very beginning of a book, right? I like being able to like write about him and then to surprise the reader or have him surprise me during the course of, you know, of the book, right? So say a character like Jojo, at the same time that he can, you know, that he can try to like emulate this very like traditional masculine behavior, he's also very nurturing, mm-hmm. right? He's mm-hmm. also something of a caretaker for mm-hmm. his sister, right?
Absolutely.
And I don't think that the reader necessarily expects that kind of behavior from a 13-year-old boy. I know I didn't expect that kind of behavior when I first started writing, you know, when I began writing the book, but that's who he became, you mm-hmm. know, as I discovered more about him and discovered more about the story. And so I think that they're interesting. I think that's really a useful thing, right? That, you know, that the characters subvert my expectations mm-hmm. and the reader's expectations, that they become more than what you think they can be in the course of the book.
I think they absolutely do. And of course, this book struck me because I mean, I have loved ones who have been incarcerated for a long time, and it's something that ricochets not just with that person, but also in families mm-hmm. and in communities. Even mm-hmm. I mean, I feel that it does. Mm-hmm. Do you agree? Do you disagree? And do you think that Sing Unburied Sing speaks to that in any way?
No, I do. I totally agree, and I do. I think that Sing Unburied Sing speaks to that. I mean, I think that's trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that trauma does it. It does. It ricochets through families, right? It and then I think that kind of trauma also affects that's part of intergenerational trauma. Like mm-hmm. it affects, you know, family members through like generations of a family, and I think that it affects us in very personal ways, right? So that it affects, you know, how we think about, you know, like how we think about ourselves and the agency we have or the agency we don't have or the power that we have, or how it affects like our prospects and our mental health and our self-esteem. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. Of course, all of that then affects the relationships that we have with each other, right? So that, you know, if we're talking about seeing like, Pop's experience in prison mm-hmm. affected him, and then later when he had, you know, when he had a wife, when he had children, then it affected how he treated them and how he interacted with them. Maybe not in, you know, maybe not in very like large, like noticeable ways, but it was there because it's part of who he is. It's part of what like made him. And then, so then, you know, his behavior then affects his, you know, his children, right? And then that affects the way that his children interact with their children. So I think, you know, I definitely think that, you know, that incarceration is something, you know, that doesn't just affect the person who is incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where, I'm glad we're having this conversation because I don't think that we talk about this enough.
Mm-mm. No, we don't. It takes away, to me, it takes away a provider and a caregiver. Mm-hmm. It takes that out of a family and out of a community. Mm-hmm. And I feel that your work addresses this intergenerational taking mm-hmm. away of, and Jojo faces that. I mean, mm-hmm. we learn later in the book that very well could happen to him, mm-hmm. as it could with many of our brothers and our mm-hmm. our fathers and our sons. And mm-hmm. so, I want to talk a little bit about why ghosts. Why did you decide to write a ghost story?
So I didn't when I began writing the rough draft of Salvage the Bones, it was just a road trip. Mm-hmm. But because I wanted to write a story that had more elements of like of magic and magical realism, I knew that this world, the rules in this world would be different, right? So from the beginning, I knew that Leonie was seeing a phantom whenever she got high, mm-hmm. right? But at the very beginning of the rough draft, she was only seeing a phantom. She was seeing a phantom of Michael, right? And I knew from the very beginning that JoJo would have certain gifts, right? That mm-hmm. he was like sort of see animals and be able to communicate with them in some respect. So I was sort of like playing around with these magical elements in my work just because I wanted to see if I could do it. And I wanted to add that element of surprise and wonder to the world that I was writing about. But I also knew from the very beginning that they were heading to parchment, right? Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all I knew when I began writing the book. I didn't know exactly what would happen on the way there or what would happen once they got there and then they were coming back home. I was directionless, I think, in some respects. But I was, because I knew they were going to Parchman Prison, I was researching Parchman Prison because I knew nothing mm-hmm. about it.
Right.
I mean, I knew about Parchman Prison as a child. I think that most children, especially black children in Mississippi, know about Parchman from when they're very young, right?
And can you fill the audience in a little bit on what Parchman is and was?
So Parchman Prison is the infamous state prison in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. I need to look this up because I keep talking about this and I can't give you an exact date, but it was established in the
I think it was 1901.
Yes, so yeah. Early, I would say like late 1800s, early 1900s. So early 1900s. And in the beginning, they changed the laws immediately, right? As soon as they finished, you know, building the prison, probably even before. So they changed the laws and they criminalized things like loitering, mm-hmm. vagrancy, right? They criminalized offenses that would impact black people more, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Especially black men, mm-hmm. because they wanted to fill this prison, right? And they wanted to decrease this population, right, mm-hmm. that they saw as a threat, mm-hmm. of former slaves, right?
Right.
They wanted
right.
to decrease this population of black people. So, you know, they wrote these ridiculous laws and they begin to, you know, populate that prison. And so in the beginning, what they did is that they rented the inmates out to local industrial barons in the region, right? So the men and boys were made to, lay track for railroads, or they were made to clear large like swaths of forest, you know, for different projects for these barons. And then they decided, you know, the powers that be in the state government and in Parchman Prison decided that they would make the prison into a farm, aka a working plantation.
Right.
And so that's what it became. And so that meant that when people were, I mean, they were already the people who were sent to Parchman Prison, they were already re-enslaved when they were, you know, clearing land and they were chained to each other. They were laying tracks and they were chained to each other. But when they decided to make Parchman into an actual plantation, then that, you know, the fact that they were re-enslaved became pretty clear, mm-hmm. because they, you know, they worked in the fields from, you know, before sunup to after sundown. They, you know, they were driven to, you know, to produce by basically overseers, but they were called sergeants, right? Mm-hmm. Who rode through the fields on horses, right? And surveyed all of the re-enslaved folks, you know, out in the fields. They were guarded by other inmates who were basically turned into guards, right? The trusty shooters. Mm-hmm. And if they tried to escape, then those trusty shooters were encouraged to kill, you know, any gunmen. That's what they called the inmates who worked in the field. So any gunmen who tried to escape, and if the guards killed the, you know, person who tried to, anybody who tried to escape, then they were instantly granted their freedom. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter what they did to get to be put in Parchman, you know, how many people they might have killed or whatever, right? They were granted their freedom. Any escapees were hunted with dogs, right? So, I mean, They were whipped with whips with Black Betty. That's what the whip was called. Like, this was very clearly re-enslavement. And that's the history of Parchment Prison. And so once I figured out, like, once I learned all of this, I knew, especially once I learned that boys as young as 12 and 13, mm-hmm. Black boys as young as 12 and 13 were sent to Parchment Prison to be re-enslaved. Like, right. Once I found that out, and I didn't know that before I read it.
Right.
You know, before I did this, like, very pointed research, right? And it made me really angry because it made me very sad and very angry because I realized that those children, their pain and this horrible, you know, their pain had been erased.
Right.
You know, their voices had been silenced, and they'd been erased from history because no one I knew about these kids. Like, so I knew that I had to write about a child, mm-hmm. specifically a child like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but I wanted to give that child power. I wanted that child to have the agency that they did not have in life. And the only way that I could do that was by making that child into a ghost. And so that's what I did. So then I was like, okay, well, I'm writing a ghost story now. And then, so then that made me look at that phantom that was visiting Leone and, like, reassess what that phantom was doing in the story, right? Because as it was, it wasn't doing anything. All it was telling me as a writer was that Leone missed Michael. And I already knew that. And it wasn't doing anything to, like, to give her some depth, mm-hmm. and to help and to reveal her motivation. And I was really struggling with her because I wasn't feeling for her. I was judging her.
Can you write from her voice, and mm-hmm. you are the mother of two young children, mm-hmm. and you write from the voice of someone who's struggling with addiction and who is layered on top of that, who can be neglectful and even cruel. Mm-hmm. How did you reach her? How did you reach her with such empathy?
It was difficult, right? I really struggled with it in the first, say, five chapters of the rough draft, right? Before I discovered Richie, and then before I went back to, like, assess this phantom that was visiting her and really to assess her as a character. I just had to pause for a second because I was like, because I realized that I didn't like her.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's problematic for me because I love all of my characters. Like, even if there are things about them that I don't like, I still feel a sense of love for them.
Yeah.
That's what motivates me. That's what drives me to make them more complicated and to, like, reveal how fragile and human, you know, and vulnerable that they are. And when I was writing about Leone, I found, as a mother, I found myself judging her,
mm-hmm.
and because her behavior was so horrible that I not only did I not like her, I definitely didn't love her, and I wasn't treating her with the tenderness and with the care, I think, that I usually treat my characters, and definitely not with the respect that I usually treat my main characters with. And so I went back and I looked at that phantom and I thought, what is motivating this behavior? Mm-hmm. I realized that what I needed to do was figure out her motivation, right? Like, what is making her so awful? What is at the root of her, not only her behavior towards her children and her parents, you know, and her friends and the people around her, right? But what is, you know, what might be at the root of her struggle with addiction?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what might underlie this at sometimes really unhealthy relationship that she has with Michael, with the father of her children. And so I thought, well, there has to be some trauma there,
right?
And I thought, well, what if she's not seeing a phantom of her, you know, the man that she loves romantically? What if there's some other loss? You know, what if someone died and this is another actual ghost in the story? And then, so I sat there for a second. I was like, okay, what if she lost a brother? What if she lost a sister? What if she lost a sibling? And that is what is sort of, that loss is sort of driving her through her life, because Leonie has a character flaw, right? And
right.
That character flaw is she can't sit with pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she can't, because that's the only way that you learn how to live with grief or loss or trauma or, you know, any horrible thing that you've experienced, or at least in the world of the novel, this is how I understand it, that you learn how to live with grief and loss and trauma. In order to do that, you have to sit with it, and you have to learn how to breathe with it and walk with it and, you know, love in spite of it. And you know what I'm saying? Like,
I do. This is a good lesson.
Yeah. Well, so you have to sit with it in order to learn how to live with it. At least that's the lesson that I've learned with grief in my own life. Right. And
right.
So I thought maybe Leonie, unfortunately, it can't do that,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so she will think about the loss of her brother, and then she immediately diverts herself. Right. And she's like, well, I want to get higher. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or I want to drink, or I want to go out with my friend, or, you know, I want to think about Michael and, mm-hmm. you know,
and be infatuated with Michael.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, and that was the key for me, right? Discovering, that trauma,
mm-hmm.
and then creating another character. So the fourth or fifth chapter onward, I wrote as if Given existed,
mm-hmm.
right? And as if I'd already written him into the, you know, the first four chapters of the book. And that was it for me. Like, that was the key to feeling for her and understanding her, and really finding her sympathetic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because in the end, she breaks your heart in a way,
yeah.
because she looks at her children, you know, she looks at the people around her, and she knows that in some respects that she is failing them, right? And she wants them to come to her for comfort,
yeah.
or come to her for, you know, nurturing or caring.
Yeah.
But she can't communicate that.
Yeah.
And she can't, it's really hard for her to like change her behavior and become less self-involved and wrapped up in her own pain to be a different mother or be a different daughter or, you know, just be a different person in general. So she's, you know, she's complicated, but I'm glad that I was able to, I think, grow and come to love her, as
yeah.
a character.
Yeah. And there's two huge, elements in this novel. Besides the characters and the richness of the characters, there's two things that I see intertwined, and those are song, which of course is resonant in the title, but also birds. In both of these I see as both supernatural and natural. I see you as a nature writer, but in this case, of course, you're bringing in that supernatural. Can you speak to both of these elements?
Song was important to me when I was writing Seeing Unburied Seeing, as you can see in the title, because I was writing about the supernatural, because I was introducing, like making this world magical in some respects, it had to have some sort of order,
mm-hmm.
you know, there had to be some sort of like underlying logic, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Mm-hmm.
And I depended a lot on, you know, because I had to do a lot of research for this book. And some of the research that I had to do was about like voodoo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And about hoodoo,
mm-hmm.
And about like herbal healing, right? But I sort of introduced magic into that, right? So I,
yeah.
So that the practitioners, right? So Ma'am, who is JoJo's grandmother, Leonie's mother, she practices voodoo, right? But she also has some sort of magical, supernatural abilities, right? And the way, and I knew, I felt like I had to create some sort of logic for those abilities. And so I thought, what if it's all tied into song?
Right.
You know, what if that's how she, that's how her magic works, right? She looks at someone, she hears singing, you know, and that helps her to sort of understand whatever is going on with them, right? Whether they're in pain or whether they, where they need healing or, and what if Richie as a ghost, like what if the divine is communicated to him or he sees it or experiences it, the divine as song and as music.
Right.
Right. And so when he gets flashes of the world, beyond his sort of ghostly existence, right? So the world that he could get to if he could get past his death, right? If he could, that world is like full of song, right? And song is like signals something of the divine, I guess. So that's why there's so much, there's so much to do with like singing
and flight.
Yeah, and flight in the book. When I was doing research on voodoo, some of the spirits of the afterlife,
mm-hmm.
like are take bird form.
Yes.
Some of them take the form of a snake's mm-hmm. form,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to sort of have a little fun with the two and smash them together,
mm-hmm.
and make that spirit of the that guiding spirit of the afterlife something that could either take a bird's form mm-hmm. or a snake's
form.
Mm-hmm.
I almost thought of the Sankofa bird. I don't know if you did or not. So there are so many things that we could talk about, but I want to open it up to the audience, to audience questions. I see one hand in the back. And audience, if you would wait for the mic to come to you before you answer the question. Before you ask, rather.
Hi. I love JoJo, but I want to ask about Richie and actually the end of the book. You say you gave them voice, but the voices at the end, there's never a release for them. I just was like devastated that Richie didn't get back, you know. So I want to talk, I would love to find out why you left them in the tree.
Spoiler alert.
It's all good.
It's in paperback, so hey. So at the same time that I was revising Sing, so I did tons of revisions of Sing. I mean, I revised Sing probably 15 times before I sent it along to my editor, right? And then once my editor, who I love, returned, you know, her feedback to me, then I went through again and did, I don't know, another 5 revisions, probably based on her feedback. So when I was in doing like the very last revision, at that time, I was also doing research for the new novel that I'm working on. And the new novel is, I'm at the very beginning of it, but it's set in New Orleans during the height of the domestic slave trade, so in the early 1800s. So I was reading this incredible book called The Half Has Never Been Told by Edward Baptist, right? And in this book, he recounts a story that enslaved people, and I don't know exactly, that they would tell each other, right? And so the story was, something that came from like an African spiritual tradition. And again, this is one of those things that I need to like return to so that I can like write it down and be able to tell you word for word what it said instead of fumbling about trying to remember. But the essence of it was that they would tell each other that when sometimes some people will die in very awful and very violent ways. And sometimes people die in such awful ways that even God has to avert his gaze. Even God can't look at it. And when their deaths, and when that happens, that person then has to, then that's when that person becomes a ghost, right? That's when a person is like, so I found that when I was doing that big final revision. And for me, that was the key that made Richie's fate, and I think the fate of many of the other ghosts that we meet in the book, it made it make sense, right? Because suddenly I had like a framework to understand why these ghosts are not able to pass on. And I think the key, especially with Richie, is that his death was so awful, he can't look at it, you know? And that's why he can't, like, once he finds out how, once he figures out how he died, I think it's such a great heartbreak for him, you know, especially because I won't spoil it anymore, but it's such a great heartbreak for him that he can't look at it. He can't live with it. And so he can't.
I'm a huge, huge fan. So I'm actually teaching Salvage the Bones right now in my class. But you have this wonderful way of being both very rooted in very visceral imagery, but also accessing this mystical connection between characters, past to present, natural world to the human world. And so I have this sense that really, despite the very bleak realities that we confront in your stories, there is also this hopefulness in the love that's shared, in a sense of interconnectedness. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you write with this mystical sense, just is it sort of intrinsic to you and who you are? Are you cultivating that sense because it is a part of your worldview of almost like, you know, the Walt Whitman interconnected world where there's this web of connection? I get that sense that you have this view of a web of connection. So I'm curious, where does that come from? Is it just instinctual, or is it both instinctual and intentional?
That's a hard one. I think that, you know, I often get the feedback, well, from some people I get this feedback, right, that, you know, that they find my work, it's too dark, right? And they want something that I can't give them. They, you know, they want happy endings, right? But I feel like, okay, I can't give you that, but I can give you a hopeful ending. You know, I can, and I think that my belief in family, in love, or, you know, in like relationships that we, you know, that we either are born into or that we find and create, you know, where we, you know, take care of other people and nurture other people and care for other people and love other people. I mean, I think that that's what allows us to survive in the larger world and to survive in the face of all, you know, that we endure. So yes, that to me, that animates my sense of hope. Right. And I think that part of the reason that it does is because, like, I look at my grandparents, you know, I look at my mom and my family members in her generation, right? My grandparents and the family members that many family members that I have who are still alive in that generation, right? And in many ways, you know, that they suffered trauma, right? I mean, they were living in the South during the 40s, you know, mm-hmm. during the 50s, during the 60s, right? You know, and they suffered, but yet they persevered, and they still had joy, and they still had hope. And I think part of what, you know, animated that joy and that hope for them was this belief that they could make their way to a better tomorrow, you know, and that the work that they did in, you know, caring for their children, nurturing their children, you know, doing their best to change the world that they lived in, meant that when their children, as their children grew older, that their children would have better lives than they did, you know, more opportunities, that their children would be able to weather whatever the world, you know, threw at them. And so I've seen that, you know, those are the stories that I've come to, you know, those are the stories that my family, you know, like, that I've gotten from people in my own family. And so I think that then that sentiment finds its way into my work, right? And the way that I sort of approach what I do in the world.
Hi, thank you for coming to Philadelphia. We're so excited to have you here. But I wanted to ask a little bit about your use of the descriptor magical realism as pertains to your work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was originally applied to Latinx writers, famously Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of pushback on that term from, you know, Latinx writers. Mm-hmm. There's a writer, Carlos Eyre, who's Cuban, and he wrote about a tiger in the courtyard, and people, you know, just reviewers describe that as part of his magical realism. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yo, fam, there was a tiger in the courtyard. Like, this is the way that our lives are. Yeah. And I think that, you know, we have on one hand this sort of American myth of individualism, and on the other hand, you know, a writer's duty to tell the truth. And the truth is often this palimpsest of land and blood and generations that kind of bubble up and come to light in unexpected ways. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about sort of your truth-telling about those generations and about how you feel that magical realism is an appropriate way to describe that.
That's a really good question. And that's actually a question that I've been afraid of getting about Sing and Buried Sing. It's one of the reasons that I have been hesitant about using the term magical realism, because I want to respect the tradition, you know, like I want to respect where this, you know, the writers who, you know, who created this, right? And who, you know, who made magical realism. And I want to respect, yeah, the tradition and the history that comes from. Because I want to respect it, I don't want to disrespect it by, like, using the term and having people who, like, who write in this tradition and who come, you know, who are Latinx writers, like, feel that I don't have, like, I don't have the right to, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't have the history and the right to use it. I don't know. I definitely feel if I'm given a pass, then I think that the history that I'm writing about is horrific and surreal enough to warrant other writers, Latinx writers, giving me that pass. But I definitely understand, you know, that we are not the originators of this tradition.
So I would say, just to clarify, that I wasn't trying to call you
No, I didn't think that you were, you know, but the reason that I say that I was even like, the reason I'm even aware of this is because I follow so many writers on Twitter, right? So many different writers of color on Twitter. And this is a discussion that I've seen, that I've seen others have, right? And I just sort of follow along. I don't say anything because I realize I have so much to learn, right? And so I've seen this, you know, conversation happening. But I think, you know, I think that sometimes when you are trying to write about something like slavery, you know, something like people being re-enslaved and beaten and, you know, and broken and lynched, and you know what I'm saying? When you're writing about that, which occurred over, you know, 300 years to millions of people, you're writing about subject matter that is so weighty and, again, so horrible and so overwhelming, and which I think pushes at the boundaries of what you think is possible as far as like human behavior is concerned, that I think that the magical realism is a very useful tool to figure out how to write about that. And I think that that's what makes it such a powerful tool, because it enables writers to write about such difficult, really weighty, heavy, absurd, you know, horrible subject matter. I hope that answered the question. I'm trying.
So I cannot thank you enough. Just to sort of wrap this up, because I feel like we cannot talk about this without talking about Black Lives Matter. We cannot talk about your work without talking about the value of Black lives. Mm-hmm. Do you consider your books in any way, or this book in particular, an open letter to your son, Brando?
I dedicated it to my mom, actually, but I mean, I think that every book I write in some respects is for both my kids. Mm-hmm. Because I know that as they get older, they're gonna encounter, you know, racism. They're gonna encounter both interpersonal and systemic racism, and they will start wrestling, you know, with all of this. You know, they as they learn more about history and about the history of the United States and Southern history, and as they, you know, hear stories that have been passed down in my family, like, they're going to realize the weight of this in their own lives. So I don't know. So I think that I hope that the stories that I write and the work that I do will help them to live with this and to navigate this as they grow older. But I'm not just writing this for my children. You know, I'm writing this for all of us, right? Because I don't think that any of us really knows how to navigate this, and we're all trying to figure it out, you know? So I don't know. I hope that I'm helping in some small way.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.